There's been issues in the past in other places in the world where people have issues with radon in their basement. And radon is an issue because if you inhale it, it then decays into its other daughter products. And the daughter products of radon are usually alpha emitters. And some of these alpha emitters are really dangerous once it's inside you.
That's Matilda Lawton from University of Sydney. And this is Me, Myself and Disaster. I'm Josh, and today we're talking about radiation. Andrew, it's something that you and I have witnessed actually firsthand as we've traveled around the world witnessing disaster zones, more recently on the north coast of Japan, the Fukushima Daiichi power plant, where many people would know there was a major nuclear disaster spreading devastation across the local area and causing impacts to this very day. Andrew, who are we talking to on the show today?
Josh, today we're talking with Matilda Lawton and Tengiz Ibrahim, who are researchers from the University of Sydney and have mapped radiation across the city with some interesting findings. This baseline data from across Sydney could one day help measure contamination from future nuclear accidents. We'll be discussing their research as well as what this means for disaster management.
Let's talk all things radiation here on Me, Myself and Disaster.
Matilda and Tengiz, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you with us because just last week I was in Fukushima and walking around the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, which is, as we know, the one that was destroyed and heavily impacted in the 2011 tsunami and earthquake. And I had a spectrometer with me called a radiocode, and it was funny, actually a long story. I wanted to go over there and see it, and I bought this device. It was a bit more than a Geiger counter, so it's got a few different features where it actually shows you what elements you're seeing and is it a count rate. But I really had no idea about radiation and what it all meant. I've been there before, and Josh and I traveled that area, and we'd seen with a Geiger counter the kind of readings you get. But it was the same time that I bought the radio code that I was reading the Sydney Morning Herald. There was an article there about your research, which basically have taken this to a much bigger scale across Sydney's first terrestrial gamma radiation map. Now, that sounds complex. Can you take us more like through what that sort of map is?
So there is natural radioactivity all around us. And this natural radioactivity, it comes from the rocks and the soil beneath our feet. So it is completely natural and around us all the time. So when we talk about terrestrial radioactivity, terrestrial is referring to the ground and the rocks, and that's where it comes from, right? And when we talk about gamma radiation, that's the specific type of radiation we're looking at. And yeah, so essentially we found that Australia has a gamma spectrometry map all across Australia. However, there are gaps, and the main gaps are in urban areas like Sydney, for example, where the most people are living. Now, this has to do with how difficult it is to detect in an urban environment. Like, usually these big detectors are flown around on planes and that's how they map the country. That's not exactly plausible when you're looking for a natural background because you're essentially getting signals from the buildings instead, right? So this radio code you're talking about essentially made this study possible, since it's a portable and small scale detector that we could take around the urban environment, right? So yeah.
And it's been a while since I've been at university and studied physics, and I kind of forgotten the basics of this sort of stuff. So in terms of gamma radiation, so I got it and put it in front of the microwave and it made no difference. I thought, like, I've been paranoid about microwave food for a long time and go, is it going to give me cancer eating a microwave meal? But it doesn't seem to pick that up. So, and I've been reading there's different types of radiation, and there's this count and the dose rate. Can you take us through just the basics of what that all means in terms of different types of radiation and how that translates to what we should be seeing in terms of risk?
So to answer your question about the microwave, the microwave radiation in it is not ionizing, meaning that it cannot separate electrons from the atoms within. All it can really do is to vibrate and rotate the molecules really quickly to heat up food. And radio code device is primarily picking up ionizing radiation, such as gamma radiation and sometimes some cosmic radiation potentially. But that's the reason really why you don't see anything when you bring it close to the microwave.
So I guess the other interesting thing to understand just before we get on is, because I know there's obviously a lot of people here about radiation and you know, as Andrew is saying, some of us have a good grasp of it and some of us don't, and we hear a lot of it. I mean, we're hearing a lot of it in the media at the moment in terms of some of the global things that are going on around the fear of, you know, radiation and nuclear attacks and all sorts of things. But can you just take us through, why is radiation harmful, or why is it something that we need to be aware of, or why is it something that we need to think about? If you want to kind of help our listeners understand the kind of the basics of that kind of radiation.
Well, I'm sure most people have taken x-rays and they know that there's a certain number of x-rays or CT scans that you can take. And the reason is that this ionizing radiation, since it can kick out electrons out of atoms, it can also sometimes rearrange molecular bonds in human tissue, which sometimes, in very rare cases, can lead to either mutations, and that can cause cancer or radiation poisoning. I am not an expert in biology fields, but that's my understanding, is that essentially it can change the human tissue in ways that it is not meant to be.
Yeah, fascinating. So back onto your study then, because I think this is something we really want to kind of unpack, and some people who would have read the story would have been surprised around some of the findings that you saw across Sydney. What would be really interesting is just to take a step by step around how you kind of undertook that study. Because as Andrew was saying, we bought our own radiated codes and started walking around the streets and were getting readings, but probably didn't quite really understand, you know, what we were looking at. And it's awesome that, you know, there's a tool now that, you know, anyone can go out and buy and actually do some of their own personal scientific research at home. But for you and your study, how did you undertake it? How did you actually go about using this tool on a day-to-day basis to collect the data?
So when we talk about the radiocode device, it's more than just a Geiger counter, as you guys alluded to before. So a Geiger counter counts the hits of a radiation particle it gets. And that's where you get the measurement, like counts per second. However, the radiocode is a spectrometer. So that means it can also measure the energy, and it can also measure the dose rate. Now, when we talk about dose rate, it's like the amount of energy absorbed by like a given, like a kilogram or a given amount of mass. And then when you put that into like the units we usually use, which is like usually equivalent dose, this takes into account the effect on actual tissues. So this is generally the kind of unit we use when we talk about the effects of radiation on the populace and all of that. So the focus of the study was to look at natural radioactivity specifically. So the first kind of part was like scouting where we would go to take these measurements, because we want to be somewhere away from buildings, away from like construction, away from other things that could give us non-natural terrestrial radiation signals, right? So we essentially found 90 parks across Sydney where we could go and take these measurements within a 10 by 10 square kilometer area. So we first found these locations where we were going to go. So we took our detector and we stood in this park and we took the dose rate measurements in this park. Now, we also technically took the counts, but what we were looking at is the dose rate, because this, as we said, gives us more of a concrete explanation of how much radiation you're actually exposed to, as opposed to the counts, because that doesn't factor in energy. So we measured the dose rate with our little detectors. There's a bit of time it takes. You need a certain amount of time before you get like a stable reading, just for how the detector works. So that's one thing. And what we also did was, in 26 of these parks, we also collected soil samples. Now, because as we said before, the radiation comes from the rocks in the soil, it's coming from actual radioactive isotopes within the rocks in the soil. Like, that's where the actual radioactivity is coming from. So measuring the soil concentrations for these particular atoms is really important, right? Like, that's where it's coming from. So we got our little soil samples, we dug them with this big soil auger, then we stuck them into little test tubes, then we sent our test tubes off. So half of them went to ARPANSA, which is the national regulatory body for nuclear safety and radiation protection. So half of them went there, and we also took the rest to NYU Abu Dhabi on a plane, which is pretty exciting. And at both of these institutions, they were tested with a HPG detector, which is like a radiocode on insane scales. So this detector is what we use for gamma spectrometry for spectrometry for very precise measurements of small things, like these small amounts of radionuclides in the soil, right? So from that, we got uranium-238, thorium-232, and potassium-40 measurements, since these are the three radionuclides that contribute the most to our natural dose of radiation.
So I guess for people at home then, in terms of, and it comes, I guess, as no surprise, like we know in essence that, you know, Australia is a resource-rich country. We have many, many natural resources and it, you know, probably wouldn't come as a surprise to some people that, you know, things that we do mine like uranium and that type of stuff, that there is that back level. But I guess, what does this study then mean for residents of Sydney? I mean, if I'm walking around in Centennial Park or if I'm going there to walk my dog every day, should I be worried? What is the safe level of radiation exposure? And I guess, what did you kind of see? Paint that picture, and we'll put up some stuff as well on our socials and other channels around some of the mapping that you developed. But can you kind of paint the picture in words for us around what you actually saw across Sydney?
Right. Well, if you had a map that we produced in front of you, you could see that the values of radiation dose were between something like 0.5 and 5. Millisievert, 0.06 and 0.5 millisievert per year. And if you check the UN values that we cited in the paper that are safe and average across the world, and if you check our PANSA regulations, you could see that this value is at least half of what's considered normal, not even abnormal, half of what is normal. And if I remember correctly, 10 millisievert per year is the value that is considered a threshold after which we start to see some health effects on humans. We are like more than 10 times below that. So for a regular person in Sydney walking their dog, I would say that you are completely fine and there is nothing really to worry about.
So I had, when I was in Fukushima, it's mostly pretty safe. It was only when I was sort of driving in there that the alarm on the device started going off. And I was like, oh, I silenced it again. It went off and off. And there was a couple of times that really interested me. So one was driving past some roadworks where I assumed they were digging up something. And I know the way Fukushima, the power plant worked, when it was hit, the waste kind of spread northwest-ish from the area into some of those towns. And so it was getting about 5 or 6 kind of microsieverts, like, is that sort of the reading on it. And then in the towns that had been really impacted, it was back down below sort of to like 1 or 2 at most. So it was pretty low again. And then close to the power plant, interesting, you may have seen there's lots of piles of soil. So they've dug all the topsoil up, put it in bags. And where they've done that, like, it was interesting. Getting out of the car was at about 1, 2, walking about 5 meters closer to the bags of soil, it was up around 5 or 6. And so it was a massive shift in the dose. And then I went for a little drive close to the power plant, got out of the car and just walked into the bush slightly. And I probably shouldn't have gone there, let's be honest. But I got to 21. But it was interesting at the sort of the like waist level where I was holding it, it was about 15. And then you put it close to the ground, immediately it went higher to 21. And so my dose rate for the day was 6 point something overall, which I think is a bit. What do those sort of levels mean in terms of healthy living? And I think if you're living in those communities, you don't go off in the bush and look for radiation like I did, you're probably okay, I understand. Is that sort of level normal? Is that sort of livable to have that sort of experience?
Because you have it per hour, right? But we have, per year, the annual normal dose. So if you multiply that by the number of hours in a year, that should be good.
Oh, I see. So if you were lying on the ground in the bush next to the power plant all year, obviously it'd be maybe bad, but if you were there for an hour, probably okay.
So yeah, it seems like given your number, so 6 millisievert per, is this per hour? Microsievert per hour. You get like
24, yeah. 365, quick maths it, yeah. Divided by 1,000 people.
So you get 52 millisievert per year, which is how many times more than what we see in Sydney?
A lot.
1,000 times more? Yeah, I think it's 1,000 times more. So I would probably say it's not good to be there for a very long time.
Yeah, okay, that's good to know. I think it was interesting, the actual sort of towns and communities that were around there, where people are living, the numbers are much less. So we were seeing there's big Geiger counters that, and when Josh and I were there, I think it was about 0.4. When I was there the other day, it was 0.2 something. So they're still quite low. Or maybe it was 0.02, but it's definitely lower than what it certainly has been. And I think those numbers are where people live. The numbers I mentioned in terms of the higher rates were certainly off the beaten track, closer to the bags of soil and that sort of thing that had been taken away.
So I think it's safe to say then Fukushima is much, much worse than Sydney, and people who are living in Sydney and reading your research probably don't have to start to stress out or start to mass sell their properties. We'll probably make that really clear as that quick equation of numbers. But I guess, where did you see some of the higher levels across Sydney? Like, did you see some areas that were much higher than others? And again, putting it in perspective, you know, when we're looking at Fukushima, looking at the background in Sydney, much, much less. But from your perspective, are there areas of Sydney that have higher radiation numbers?
So we see a variation across Sydney. We see a spatial variation. Now, the strongest control, what's known, and what you see all over the world, is that the strongest control on natural radioactivity, because it's natural we're looking at, is the geology. So it's actually the lithology beneath your feet, because that's what's controlling the concentration of these radionuclides that are producing the radioactivity. So in Sydney, we have, to simplify it, we have like three main lithologies, like types of rock. Mm. So we have the Hawkesbury sandstone, which is what all the nice buildings are made of, which you'd know. We have the Ashfield shale, and we have quaternary sediments. So the sandstone and the shale, they are Triassic in age, so they're more than 200 billion years old. 200 million years old. And then the quaternary sediments are much, much young. So the quaternary period is like the most recent period in geological timescales. So we expect that these quaternary sediments, so these are sediments derived from older rock, right? So they've essentially had the mineral, like they are what doesn't want to stay in the rock, right? Mm. So the potassium, uranium, and thorium I talked about, the minerals that these are in, particularly the uranium and the thorium, they want to stay in the mineral. They don't want to, and these minerals don't want to erode out. So when we get these younger sediments, essentially we expect much less uranium and thorium. Like it will still be there. It's always going to be there, but we expect much less. So that's what we see, basically, in what we found. There's not heaps and heaps of variation, but again, we've seen that the level is quite low. But the areas where we see the higher levels of radioactivity, they are actually in the sandstone, which adds up with kind of what we expect. But again, it's safe. It's not very high. Now, something as well, right, is that we've tried to minimize the effect of anything that's not natural. So we've tried to do it in parks, and we've tried to say, like, this is natural. However, there may be factors of industrial activity and things like that, which can elevate the level of radionuclides as well. So the area that was the most radioactive was Glebe, but it's completely fine. However, it used to be a large industrial center. So something we might look into further is whether we can see signals of that industrial effect and see if we can disentangle that from natural and say, no, it's actually not just natural, it's because of this. So that's something that could potentially be having an effect.
Hey everyone, just a quick one. If you're enjoying this chat, make sure you hit that like or subscribe button on whatever app you're using. That way, you'll never miss an episode. Let's get back to the show.
So if we were to have, say, a disaster tomorrow in Sydney, is there potential for this to be disturbed? So say you had even a big flood on the Hawkesbury Nepean River, and it's passing through areas of the Blue Mountains or Warragamba Dam, where you have lots of those older Hawkesbury sandstone rocks you mentioned. Does that sort of trigger any release of, say, uranium, or is there a greater exposure to radiation coming from those sediments? Is that how it works? Or if there's an earthquake, doesn't really disturb it?
When you're talking about, when we think about something like this and we're thinking about like a release, so we know that the minerals, the uranium, the thorium, and the potassium are in the minerals, right? Now, they like decay by radioactive decay. That's not so much like a release that could be like triggered if you think about that. However, something like radon, which is a decay product, which can come from either the thorium or the uranium decay chain. Radon is a radioactive gas, and this is also what causes issues. So there's been issues in the past in other places in the world where people have issues with radon in their basement. And radon is an issue because if you inhale it, it then decays into its other daughter products. And the daughter products of radon are usually alpha emitters. And some of these alpha emitters are really dangerous once it's inside you. So radon is an issue. So something like, so radon can be released more easily from like cracks and fractures in the rock. Like it's kind of like a pathway for it. However, if you're outside and if you're like, you know, in a well-ventilated environment, it's generally not too much of an issue. So our Panzer has a radon potential map of Australia. Now, in this map, Sydney is only one data point. So it's not super, like it's not got a very high resolution, but radon doesn't appear to be an issue in Sydney as it is. However, yeah, if something like this happened, potentially you could have a bit more release and things like that. But I don't think it's anything that's particularly concerning. And especially like, yes, groundwater as well will also have like some of this. But again, it's not like the levels we're seeing here are fine. And it's likely like because we have rocks that don't have lots of it. If you had a granite, for example, or something volcanic, it might be more of an issue. But we don't here. We're quite lucky. We've got sedimentary rocks, which have evolved over time and become the products of what has already been. So there's much less of what we see. So yeah.
And in places like Fukushima, where that soil has been exposed to radiation and it contains radioactive materials, what's the time frame for that sort of breaking down? If you've got uranium and those sort of products in there, is that going to be millions of years? Are we looking at this is going to be sort of something that is safe in the near future?
Well, so it depends on what kind of nuclides you have in your soil sample that you had there. Because I assume the ones that were from in Fukushima are anthropogenic ones, and you would have to look at specific ones and their decay times. But the thorium-232 and uranium-238 that are natural and present everywhere, their half-life time is on the order of the universe's existence length. So like 10 billion years, 14 billion years, something like that.
So quite a while.
So yeah, that's why they are still there in the ground, because since the Earth's formation, they are still decaying to this day.
Wow.
Could be a while.
That's a long time. Well, on that then, I guess, how does this data help to build, I guess, this background picture of radiation in Sydney so that we can kind of better understand nuclear instances? And then obviously just from a day-to-day health perspective, you know, what is kind of the impact of this research from your perspective, apart from obviously some bragging rights of some suburbs to another suburb that we've got less radiation than you do? You know, what are some of those kind of real important impacts or things that we should be taking away from this research, or things that you've kind of identified that, hey, this is something we need to look at further into the future?
So one thing I would think of first, and then Matilda can maybe continue on that, is that now that we have a background level, we more or less know what is to be expected. Mm. And then if in the future this continues and becomes a monitoring system, then you could see changes in the levels that are more than just noise that you would expect. And then you would know that something is happening in some places and you can investigate further. Of course, radiation is very important to health and of the population. And it also could point us toward radon leaks in some places, especially if, for example, it happens in underground facilities like subway or basements of public spaces. In order to know that there is an increase or there is an abnormal amount, you need to know the baseline that we have done.
What's if people are worried about like radiation in Sydney, how can people minimize their radiation exposure? Is there a way that people can sort of minimize that? Or and I'm particularly interested in around cosmic radiation, because I tend to fly on planes a lot, and people say, oh, it's like flying to London is like a chest x-ray. And I think, oh, geez, should I be doing that? And even some places when you fly, I think Sydney to Perth is apparently quite bad in terms of greater exposure to the poles. Are you able to talk about in terms of how we can minimize our radiation exposure?
Yes. So essentially, as it stands, if you're a resident in Sydney right now, your general day-to-day, you do not need to worry. So our PANSA, this regulatory body, says that you can have above your natural radioactivity, like your natural exposure, your background, and personal medical things. It says you can have 1 millisievert a year. You will be, unless you do a lot of flying, you should be all right under that. A 20-hour flight is approximately 0.1 millisievert, right? Contributing to your annual dose. However, something like a CT scan, so there's a limit of CT scans, of the number of CT scans you can have a year because of your radiation dose, right? So one CT scan to your abdomen specifically is about 10 millisieverts per year. So that's like reaching your upper limit. So there's like, you know, this is what you have. So cosmic radiation is something, yeah, we can't avoid. So even down on the surface of Earth. So cosmic, as the name would imply, it comes from space. So we have these high energy particles, which are generally majority protons when they come from space. They hit the Earth's atmosphere. And in the Earth's atmosphere, which protects us, there's other interactions. It interacts with the molecules in the atmosphere, and then we get other particles. So we get these other particles which come raining down on us. There's a constant rain of cosmic radiation down on Earth. However, that attenuates as you get all the way down to the surface, right? So there's much less down here as there is up there. And this is why we talk about airplane flights. We have more cosmic radiation because we're higher in altitude, and altitude is one of the main controls on how much cosmic radiation dose you get. So yeah, so unless you are taking lots of flights, you should be okay. And we don't need to worry as it stands. I mean, if we're living in an area that is relatively safe, you are okay as it stands.
So to summarize, don't fly too much. Don't go to broken down nuclear power plants. And apart from that, we're good.
Yeah. And don't be an astronaut. If you're an astronaut, then you get heaps of cosmic radiation. And that's
I'll cross it off my dream list.
Yeah. If you really don't want to avoid radiation, if you really want to avoid radiation, don't be an astronaut.
Sounds like a plan. I'll make sure to have that conversation with my kids next, what do you want to be for when you become an adult day. I guess to kind of wrap up this conversation, I think it's been really valuable, even though it's kind of a little bit out of the spectrum of what we normally discuss on this show. It's really interesting because, as I said, you know, nuclear radiation, you know, what we've seen in the past in some of the disasters, especially as Andrew said at Fukushima and Chernobyl and other things, it's obviously something that's in people's minds. It's been really good just to talk to you guys around understanding a little bit more about radiation and actually what it means, and that, you know what, it actually is naturally occurring. It's around us every day that we interact with the world and we're outside doing things. But I guess where next for your research and where next for you guys? Where do you want to take this and what do you want to do with it?
So as I have mentioned, radon is a potential issue. And if this project is to continue, we would like to, using the base radiation level, to make a radon map of Sydney, starting from crucial infrastructure places where there is a risk, as I have mentioned already, subway or metro, as they call it here. Yeah, and maybe public schools, hospitals, other important places where there's a lot of people and there may be a poor ventilation. And we would like to make develop a rather cheap radon detector that could be in a similar fashion distributed, and we can take data in different places and make a new map so that you're informed of places where you could see more radon. And that could also go to help miners potentially in the mines, because underground, when there is a lot of these rocks and poor ventilation, radon is even bigger issue. And then there, you could potentially give detectors to those miners to monitor their exposure of radon, so that if they see a big spike, they can just stop working, then go up to the surface and wait until it's fine, ventilate the space, and then go back down again.
Maybe this could turn into a bit of a social experiment, and we could give a heap of radiator codes out there and have people walking the...
potential. Do you want to talk about it?
Well, so there is actually a database where you can upload your radio code data to the internet. So radio code have this thing called Radioverse, and it's a global map of where people upload their data from their radio codes wherever they've been. You can also do it like driving, things like that. So there is if you can have a look, go onto this website, see if where you're going has particularly high radiation levels and things like that. Now, as is the case with citizen science, you don't actually know like 100% how these people took the measurements, but something like Radioverse is actually really interesting because you can look, you can like filter for like the speed at which the data points were taken. So you can see if that person was driving and see if they were walking. So that's pretty cool. But yeah, so this database is already kind of existing, which is another really cool part of these detectors that people can just buy. Like the public can get involved in this radiation protection, which is really important for people becoming aware and educated about radiation, and especially about the fact that this natural radioactivity is all around us and that generally, especially in Sydney now, we know it is safe.
It's always a bit of a, like, I found a bit of a game over in Japan to go, where can I get the highest radiation number? Which is probably not a safe game to play.
But maybe not the safest game to play.
It makes kind of visiting places more interesting. And when Josh and I went for a drive the other day, like, it was interesting. We just got the results are quite just, I don't know, we went past an old petrol station and the result was slightly higher. We passed a truck on the drive and we thought maybe that's kind of containing some sort of fertilizer or something. Like, it seems to be quite sensitive what it picks up. And does he kind of go, what's in the world around us? It makes you think a bit more of what's in the world around us. And in a disaster sense, when that is disrupted, and you need to be aware of all the different consequences and impacts, I think that's even more important. So it's been, yeah, fascinating to learn more about that.
To the point of citizen science, that we are currently trying to make a lab experimental component for here in the university. It's still not there yet, but we are trying to develop it where students would take radiation measurement devices and go out and then either make the map, increase the resolution of the map, or go to outside of the map and then extend it. That's one thing that we could try. And then if that system of citizen science, where you have more trust in your data, picks up, then we could maybe potentially do that in other universities, in other cities across the country. And then you would fill in the gaps that Matilda has mentioned in the Arpanza map, because it couldn't fly over cities. And another thing, maybe to mention that ANSTO as a nuclear facility, it seems very safe. And I have actually went to ANSTO as a trip last month or 2 months ago. And we saw the reactor ourselves. And the reactor water is at 45 degrees Celsius. You're like, if you could take that water, you could make a cup of tea with it. And there is no pressure. There is no generators. So I think like the ANSTO nuclear facility is very, very safe. And like in case of a disaster, I don't expect anything to happen with it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. For listeners outside of Sydney, ANSTO is the government's nuclear facility in Sydney. It's not used for power generation. It's used for medical research and other things. Good to know, because there's always a concern. People think, oh, what happens if there's an earthquake? Would that be okay? Would there be some sort of incident in Sydney if that happened? But I think looking at the comparison between ANSTO and even Fukushima and some of the power plants in Japan, which are sitting right on the ocean where there is a tsunami risk, there's a very small seawall there where it came in and it was impacted both by the earthquake. Well, it survived the earthquake, but then it was later severely damaged by the tsunami at about 3:37 p.m., about 45 minutes after the earthquake hit. And that's when trouble started for the days after that. I think ANSTO is a very different facility and hopefully would be okay here in Sydney.
I think it's just important for people to know that nuclear is not always as dangerous or scary and could be like good for you.
Yeah, no, that's very good to know. Well, Matilda and 10 Gears, it's been really fascinating talking to you today. Thank you both for joining us. We've learned heaps around radiation, particularly from a disaster perspective, and we've shared links to your study and to the radio code device we've been speaking about in the show notes and on our website. And you can also find on our website photos and clips from our time in Fukushima at meetmyselfdisaster.com, as well as on our social media channels. Matilda Lawton and Tengiz Ibrahim, thanks for joining us on Me, Myself and Disaster.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for on the show today. Join us again next time on Australia's leading disaster podcast as we talk to more interesting guests from across the world about their experiences during disasters. We'll catch you then. Me, Myself and Disaster is a production of Beyond Disaster. Find out more at beyonddisaster.au.